Around this time, every 4 years, I find myself growing a bit wistful as I consider the life I once intended to lead. You see, there is both video evidence and a written record in third grade scrawl that my earliest chosen profession was, you guessed it, President of the United States. Now, I imagine that having this ambition as an 8-year-old does not make one unusual. But what may set me apart is the gusto with which I pursued it. I distinctly remember having to tell my parents, so that my teacher would not, that I had been sent into the hall for 10 minutes as punishment for arguing too passionately the relative merits of Ross Perot's tax plan, and for interrupting those other third graders with whom I disagreed. Now, despite all that I could offer him, Ross Perot lost the election, my first of many political defeats. But my interest in the political world continued to be strong, and I arrived as a freshman in college with an only slightly revised version of that vocational goal. The changes that resulted in my enrolling at Columbia Seminary 4 years later were gradual but steady. There are two college friends in the sanctuary this morning who could attest to that. The most important of those changes was a growing awareness of my intense and enthusiastic love for the church. My initial sense of call to ministry came as a realization that the Christian community, at its best, is the most compelling and vital force for good in the world today. More than any corporation, governmental agency, or nonprofit organization, the church has the ability to change the world. The passage just read from Matthew's Gospel is one part of the most well-known and oft-repeated sermon in the history of the world, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. I've always imagined the Sermon on the Mount exactly as it appeared in the picture depicting it in my children's Bible. Jesus standing upright on top of the mountain, high above an immense and innumerable crowd of people. A kind of mix between the opening scene of Disney's The Lion King and a Billy Graham stadium crusade. So you can imagine my surprise when I read Matthew's depiction of the Sermon on the Mount and found that the reason that he climbs that mountain is to get away from the crowds of people. There is no large crowd waiting for Jesus to stand before them on that mountaintop. In fact, in the picture that Matthew paints, Jesus is not even standing. He sits down, and his disciples gather around him. These new disciples, our very first ancestors in Christian faith, are the only congregation to which Jesus preaches this sermon. This sermon, then, is not one for the whole world. It is intended for the community of faith. And we should listen closely to what Jesus says to those who will carry his message to the world. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Jesus gives his followers a message of hope that is dependent upon their living up to the high calling that they have been given. It is an affirmation and a plea for action. It is a promise and a command. It is blessed assurance and a charge to keep. It is a statement of what the church already is and what the church must do in the world. And I can think of no more important words for the Church of Jesus Christ here and now than these words from Jesus. I do not have to explain to you that we live in difficult times for the Christian community. We live in what many call a post-Christian or even post-religious nation. Most congregations are declining, both in numbers and in energy. The mainline denominations of which we are a part no longer hold the power and influence that they did early in the 20th century. When the New York Times used to publish Harry Emerson Fosdick's sermons every Monday morning, can you imagine that? The church is ailing from decades of internal struggle over questions of doctrine and biblical interpretation. The church is weakened by centuries of division and conflict. Ours are difficult days for the Church of Jesus Christ. And the response of many in our culture, in our city, in our nation, has been to call it quits, to stay away from church altogether, to join the ranks of what Joanna might call the Sunday brunch brigade. Well, others have continued to be involved in the church, but have become what we might call undercover Christians. You know the type. I'm a Christian, but it's not really a big deal. I'm not a fanatic. I don't even go to church every Sunday. Every time I hear those phrases or any of their rhetorical relatives, I cringe a bit. If faithful believers have become embarrassed to confess their faith or live it out in the world, then the future of the church is indeed bleak. But the biblical witness and my own experience of the church point to something else, to another possibility. Consider the passage read from Deuteronomy this morning, a plea to the Hebrew people to remember who they are. They stand poised to enter the land of Canaan after 40 years wandering in the wilderness, and the temptation they will face as they enter the promised land will be to claim complete credit for their triumphant entry into Canaan. The temptation will be to forget that it was God who led them out of Egypt, God who parted the Red Sea, God who provided streams in the desert and nourishment in a barren land. Moses' words in Deuteronomy stand as a constant corrective to self-congratulation. It was not because you were more numerous and powerful that you were chosen by God. It was only because the Lord loved you, and don't you forget it. And yet it is the chosenness of the people that matters most. It ensures that they will have what it takes to be a blessing to all nations. The faithfulness of God, not fragile, fleeting faith of humans, but the faithfulness of God is to be the bulwark on which the community of faith is built. In the Sermon on the Mount, the command of Jesus for his followers to be salt and light in the world is not for the purpose of self-aggrandizement. Rather, we are to be light bearers to the world, quote, so that they may see your good works and give glory to God. The church is not in the business of self-promotion, but of pointing beyond itself to the relentless activity of God in the world. the church wasn't even our idea. This peculiar gathering of diverse persons is a notion that could only have been formed in the heart and mind of God. You and I, we must admit that we Christians are peculiar people. Our movement began that way, far from the houses of power in ancient Rome or the religious establishment in Jerusalem, in a land called Nazareth, where an ordinary human being began to proclaim that God, with all divine power and otherness, was closing the distance that separates us from others, ourselves, and our God. The early church was peculiar in its insistence on living out the odd teachings of its Lord. Enemy love, strength through service, gaining by giving. Peculiar indeed. And yet driven by something deeper and more powerful than those who claimed their authority from military power or political influence. These peculiar people owed allegiance primarily and wholly to the God who gave them life and the Lord who called them into service. It was a different way of seeing the world then, and it still is. 2 weeks ago at the Men of Morningside's monthly Theology on Tap program, we had a spirited conversation on Christian fundamentalism. At the end of the evening, I invited the 30 men who were gathered to consider the question, what are the fundamentals of your faith? What are those aspects of your belief system that you could never compromise? After a moment to think through the question, I asked for volunteers to share their fundamentals. What emerged from the group was a stunning communal confession of faith. The responses were profound and deeply personal. The room was so full of light and salt that the world so acutely needs. One of the final answers given was this one. I fundamentally believe that God is still active in the world. No phrase could have better summarized my theology in that moment. Here was a group of 30 men who could be described as otherwise very normal, sharing such peculiar ideas. Beliefs that did not come from the surrounding culture, but from their faith in something bigger and more significant than their own lives in the world. The light in the room was so bright I had to shield my eyes. I left that evening so invigorated about the potential of the church in the world today. After our service today in the parlor, we will have the opportunity to hear from Bill Bowling, who is the founder and executive director of the Atlanta Community Food Bank. A few weeks ago, I attended a breakfast at which he spoke. In a time of economic crisis, staggering unemployment, dire predictions of hunger and homelessness, and winter coming, much anxiety about the future, Bill said something quite peculiar. He said, "This is a great time to be the church." He explained that people all over the country are re-examining priorities and becoming introspective about their lives. And then he said, "We in the faith community have what people most need and what they are looking for now. Salt and light, flavor and vision, what people most need in these troubled times. It is time, brothers and sisters, it is time for believers in this country to stand together as the one body of Christ in the world. It is time to open the doors of the church wide enough so that all feel welcomed and indispensable to our mission. It is time to walk out of those open doors into the world in acts of justice, mercy, and love that shed light and scatter salt. It is time for us to live up to the high calling that we have been given. I thank God our time is now. Our time to witness to a God who is larger than any four walls, any theology or denomination, any nation or race, any gender or sexual orientation, any political party or ideology. Our time to show the world the power of a united church. Our time to be the church in and for the world. I cannot tell you how important people of faith are in the world right now. We live in a world that is crying out for hope and vision. A world that longs for peculiar people who stand firm in faith and proclaim the belief that only God can save us. We cannot be saved by military power or force. We cannot be saved by consumerist mentalities or economic security. We cannot be saved by fences or gates. We cannot be saved by hoarding what is ours and refusing to see the needs of others. We cannot be saved by stubborn refusal to change or accept what is new. We cannot be saved by nationalist allegiances that trump religious faith. We cannot be saved by government rescue plans or bailouts. We cannot even be saved by ourselves. To be a Christian, to be a person who trusts in God above all else, is to hold on to that antiquated and unsophisticated belief that human beings are not in total control of the world. And it is that belief that frees us to joyful service and abundant life. What we are called to is not easy in our day. It never has been easy. It involves deep trust in that which is larger than ourselves. It involves confessing our sinfulness and our participation in a sinful world. It involves relying on one another and admitting that we cannot make it alone. It involves standing courageously in the face of injustice and despair and proclaiming a new and different world on its way. It will take all the faith that we can muster and all the passion that we can devote. But I can think of nothing more worthy of our energy, nothing more deserving of our life's dedication. Because you are the light of the world. So come, peculiar people of God. Come, Church of Jesus Christ, this is no time to hide away. Now is the time to shine brightly for all the world to see.